We're now in Victoria Tower Gardens, and rather fine statue in front of us here. This is of Emmeline Pankhurst. She was the leader of the Women's Political and Social Union, otherwise known as the Suffragettes. They had a very vigorous campaign to get votes of women in the early part of the 20th century. They tried by conventional means, by petitioning Parliament and Buckingham Palace, all fell apart. They resorted to guerrilla tactics. These sometimes middle-class ladies would go into the ladies' gallery of the House of Commons, and if an anti-suffrage MP stood up, they'd all shout, "Votes for women!" Then bags of flour and rotten eggs would be thrown over them. They went into jail, went on a hunger strike, had a very high-profile campaign, and finally granted the vote in 1918, at the end of the First World War, because of the work they'd done in the war. And they were given the vote, provided they're over the age of 30, and registered as householders, later given the vote at the age of 21 in 1928. Now, of course, it's 18 is the age and universal suffrage. Now, the first woman to be elected could not take her seat. This was Constance, or Countess Markovitch, and she was a member of Sinn Féin, the Irish Republican movement. The first person to take her seat was a lady called Nancy Astor, a very formidable lady born in Virginia in the USA, and she stood as a member for Plymouth and fought against the evils of alcoholism and had dreadful trouble with that well-known alcoholic Churchill. They loathed each other, both personally and politically. At one point, she said to my God, Winston, she said, if I had married you, I'd poison your coffee. And Churchill said, Nancy, if I were your husband, I'd drink it. Well, Churchill was well known for knocking about the booze, and he sometimes drank half a pint of champagne and two double barrels while speaking in the House. And he once came out of Annie's Bar, the Commons Bar, completely plastered. And Bessie Braddock, MP for Liverpool, built like a tank with a great big nose, came up and said, Winston, you're horribly drunk. He said, Bessie, you're horribly ugly, but in the morning I shall be sober. Always got the last word. Now, we got to Emmeline Pankhurst. I'm going to show you another statue, quite a famous one, incidentally, just around the corner here. And it shows a group of six men looking rather woebegone, and they are the burghers of Calais, or the bourgeois of Calais. It's a story of the city of Calais in northern France, besieged by Edward III to the point of starvation in the 1340s. Now, if a city had not officially surrendered, which they'd not, the victor could go in there and just slaughter everybody. He's going to do this. And six citizens came out and said, we'll be hostages for our city, spare our city. He was going to hang them as an example when Queen Philippa, his wife, pleaded for their lives and the lives of sages. An example of people prepared to give their all for their fellow citizens. And yes, last year it was quite a hot summer. We had a guy selling hamburgers and hot dogs just by them, and I said, this is the hamburger of Calais. Didn't quite get the joke, but never mind. Now, coming over to the river here, come to the river wall, and you see the state of the river. It's a very tidal river. You can see the dark line on Westminster Bridge there. That's high tide. It goes in and out twice a day. That's why it looks disgusting, because it's mud being pushed backwards and forwards. But it is pretty clean. You can catch a lot of fish in the river. You can even see a cormorant, one of the lifebuoys there, ready to dive for fish. Now, Westminster Bridge over there, that was opened in the 1860s, during the reign of Queen Victoria. And it's the only bridge over the Thames with seven arches, all the magnificent structure. And then you've got the other impressive structure behind it, the London Eye, the Great Wheel. It goes up to a height of 155 metres, 455 feet. And from the top gondola, you can see right across to Windsor Castle on a clear day, a view of 40 kilometres. I know this because my daughter was married and we hired a gondola for a champagne party surprise, cost her an absolute fortune. And there was Windsor Castle. You can even get married on the wheel. You say, I do at the top, and it's downhill from there on, of course, but anyway. So you've got the wheel there, which is a Euro wheel. The design was British. The steel is German, the engineering was Dutch, the gondolas are French, the wires are Italian, and the motor in the centre was made in the Czech Republic. Just to the right of it is the building with the green tower. That's County Hall, opened by King George V in 1921, and it was the seat of government for the outlying boroughs of London, the 37 boroughs. That was disbanded. It was called the GLC in the 1980s, during the reign of Margaret Thatcher, and it's now a Marriott Hotel, an aquarium and a McDonald's restaurant, so a complete cultural centre there. The governing body is now the GLA, Greater London Authority, and thereby Tower Bridge. Now we have another complex of buildings over here. You can see the St. Thomas's Hospital, and this was founded here in the 1870s, and it's where Florence Nightingale established her school for nurses. The nursing students here are still referred to as Nightingales. My mother was a Nightingale here in World War II. My grandson born on the sixth floor here. And the last time I went in, I had my hands stuck together with super glue. They said name, I said idiot. So I've got a personal connection there. Now to the right of it, you can see a complex of buildings with a blue flag flying. That is Lambeth Palace, the official seat of the Archbishops of Canterbury in London, and has been their seat here since the 12th century. So the present Archbishop, Justin Carey, is in residence because his flag is flying, and you can actually do a tour of Lambeth Palace if you book online, and you can see one of the largest private gardens in London. You can see some of the earliest Bibles printed in the English language, and the gloves worn by Charles I at his execution, and the guardroom where Thomas More was interrogated but been taken down to the tower. To the right, you've got a church tower there. That's the Church of St. Mary at Lambeth. No longer a church, but now the Museum of Garden History, and a fascinating place well worth visiting. Now, just over here, you have this rather curious construction that's rather like somebody's sliced off a church steeple and stuck it here. This was in fact, a drinking fountain which stood in Parliament Square, and it was built to celebrate the ending of the iniquitous slave trade. People like Macaulay and Buxton, and this is known as the Buxton Memorial Fountain. And over here, by the way, you've got a very good view of Victoria Tower, and you can see the flag flying. Traditionally, the flag is the largest Union flag in the country. Swivel around a bit and you've got some other buildings. You've got beyond the roundabout there by Lambeth Bridges, MI5, our internal security service, and next to it on the other side of the street is a building which was part of Empirical Chemical Industries, or ICI, originally, and where a young lady was interviewed in the 1950s. At the end of the interview, the chairman wrote a memo: on no account give this young woman a position. She's extremely stubborn and very self-opinionated. That was Margaret Thatcher. Didn't get a job there. Anyway, more of her later on. We're going to go across now, entering an area known as Lobbyland, a very political village. And we're approaching a rather handsome church, the Church of St. John Smith Square. It's got these curious spiky things on top. They're meant to be pineapples, ancient symbols of hospitality and welcome. Now, this church is no longer used as a church, rather like St. Mary at Lambeth. It's now a concert hall. Very fine acoustics in here, and underneath is a splendid wine bar and restaurant. Just to the left is Transport House, formerly the headquarters of the Labour Party. On the other side were the Conservative Party, and round the corner were the Liberal Democrats. All these political headquarters in one small place. That's why it's known as Lobbyland. They've all moved away now, but the houses here to the right date from the 1720s, and they're sometimes used as political, conspiracy centres, shall we say. I was once doing a tour when John Major was Prime Minister and his job was under threat, yet again. And a house on the corner was used by Michael Portillo, who was then a rising Conservative rival. And a journalist saw my group standing there and said, "Excuse me," he said, "which lobby are you?" And I said, "We're London Walks." Didn't know who we were at all. Thought a new political party. Now, the street running down here is called Lord North Street. You can just see the title up there. And Lord North was Prime Minister in the 1770s. He tried to persuade King George III not to go to war against the revolution in America. Of course, we know what happened. Of course, George III was slightly bonkers. We lost everything. And somebody's in charge now until the last Trump, I suppose. And Lord North was in the theatre once with a political friend sitting in a box, and a woman waved from the other side of the auditorium, and he waved back, and his friend said, "Excuse me, Lord North, who's that ugly woman just waved to?" He said, "That was my wife." "Oh, no, I didn't mean her, I'm on the one next to her. That was my daughter." "It's all right, we are the three ugliest people in London." A good sense of humour, anyway. Now let's do some name-dropping. Coming in Lord North Street, we just stopped here by number 8, and you can see on the wall here, rather faint, S for shelter, and then another sign, public shelters in vaults under pavements in this street. So if the air raid siren started in 1940, they'd all dive down the stairs and underneath here to protect themselves against bombs. There's a similar one directly opposite number 16. You can see it fading on the wall over there. At number 16, by the way, was Thaumur Berenson. He was the great American art expert, and you'd bring your Italian Renaissance painting to him. He'd give you the provenance of it and the history and also the value, and he'd charge you 10% of the valuation as his fee. He made a lot of money out of that. And number 14 across there was Thaumur Binky Beaumont. Now, he was a theatrical impresario and put on a whole load of productions in the West End, both before and after the war, and had people like Laurence Olivier going there for parties, and John Gielgud and Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and Marilyn Monroe stayed there in the 1950s when she was filming here. Now, this house, number 8, this was the home of Brendan Bracken. Brendan Bracken was the disciple of Winston Churchill, and he was the head of Ministry of Information in 1940. For Ministry of Information, read Minister for Propaganda. And later on, it was the home of Jonathan Aitken, who was a Member of Parliament, and he was a favourite of Margaret Thatcher, in fact engaged to her daughter Carol at one point, and things fell apart. He was found guilty of perjury and spent time in jail and had to sell the house. Who's there at present, I don't know, but finding out who lives here is not an easy task. A bit further down, you've got a red brick house on the corner of Great Peter Street, and that's the home of Lord Ashcroft of Belize, a very powerful and influential Conservative peer. And he was hoping to get a job in David Cameron's government and didn't get it. And in revenge, left the Conservative Party and wrote a book all about David Cameron's misspent youth called Call Me Dave, including an episode with a part of a dead pig, which in the interests of public taste, I'm not going into details. The house is always shuttered. You never know what's going on there. It's a strange conspiracy centre. Now let's come down across here into Cowley and Barton Streets, and you can see there's a house up at the top there. All the shutters are drawn. Right at the very top, under skylight there, on the garret window, is a sign saying, No Deal, No Problem. This is the house of Jacob Rees-Mogg, a very eccentric and right-wing conservative, and he made his fortune from dealing in hedge funds, particularly with some Russian oligarchs. And he's a very fervent Catholic and has had 6 children. The last one was called Sixtus. And his wife recently stated, there will be no Septimus. So what she's done about that, I don't know, but that's Jacob Rees-Mogg's house. Somebody a bit more admirable down here, I think. Oh yes, here we are. Blue plate on the wall commemorating Sir John Gielgud, the great classical actor of the 20th century. His performances, particularly as Hamlet, were regarded as groundbreaking. A wonderful man, great musical voice, spoke like that, and completely tactless. You know the film, The Rocky Horror Show. There was an actor in it called Charles Gray, who played the narrator, didn't think very much of. He also played a Bond villain. And John Gielgud went to this restaurant. There was Charles Gray eating his lunch. I said, oh, for a frightful moment, I thought you were that dreadful actor, Charles Gray. Oh, you are! Oh, my God! I was saying the wrong thing. This was unveiled by Ian McKellen and Judi Dench a couple of years ago. Now, directly opposite, a very different character. You had a blue circle commemorating John Reith. Now, John Reith was the head of the British Broadcasting Corporation, or the BBC, in his early days. Very strict Scotsman who insisted that newsreaders wear evening dress when reading the news, and if there was a play reading, actors would all have to wear makeup in front of the microphone. But radio first started, it was a great hit, and he was at this reception. It was a very little bishop, very short bishop, and Reith was quite tall, and the bishop, holding his sherry, looked up and said, Oh, hello, and who are you, and what do you do? He said, I'm Reith. I'm in charge of the BBC. Oh, radio. Oh, it's frightfully good. It's frightfully good. The trouble is, I do find it very uncomfortable in winter.
Why is that?
Well, I've got to keep the window open so the radio waves could come in. And when they first started transmitting television signals in 1936, he thought television was a dreadful idea. It's going to sap the morals of the nation. How right he was. Now, okay, so there was another delightful case of, this is 1940, and he was there, the Director General in his office, and documents had come in. This producer came in, rather red-faced, and said, Director General, we have a bit of a problem. Well, what is it? Spit it out. A freebie. We found an actress and the chief engineer. Oh, God. Having sex on the table in Studio One. He said, right, sack them both. We can't, sir. We can't. Think of the newspapers. Very well. Burn the table. Interesting solution, I think. Now, that's two blue plaques. Let's find a third one on the next corner. This is a real surprise. So here on the wall, we've got a plate commemorating T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. An extraordinary charismatic character. He was the illegitimate son of an Irish landowner, wanted to prove himself tougher than anybody else. He translated Latin and Greek, he was an archaeologist and heaven knows what. And at the Arab Bureau in Cairo, in the First World War, he managed to unite the various Bedouin tribes as an effective guerrilla force against the Ottoman Empire. You may well have seen the film Lawrence of Arabia, a very romanticised version by David Lean, with Peter O'Toole playing Lawrence. Noel Coward knew Lawrence in life very well, and there was Peter O'Toole with blonde hair and blue eyes. And anybody who put here had to call him Florence of Arabia. But Florence, beg his pardon, was writing his memoirs here, called The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And when he also died in a motorcycle accident in 1935. He was always crazy about going faster and faster. Now, a bit further on at the corner there, you've got a house which was actually owned by Lord McAlpine, who was a very close friend of Margaret Thatcher. And Margaret Thatcher had to seek refuge here when she was kicked out by her own troops. She was actually kicked out by her own party. She was not a consensus politician, Margaret Thatcher. She just always knew that she was right. One journalist said, but Prime Minister, what happens if the cabinet disagrees on this point? She said, well, I just feel very sorry for them. Her cabinet was once described as a tigress surrounded by hamsters. And she was given the sobriquet Attila the Hen by one Labour politician. And the Russians dubbed her the Iron Lady. And then socially said after she died, the Iron Lady, may she rust in peace. And we'll leave you in peace just for a moment.